This is Catherine O'Connell and welcome to Lawyer on Air. If you are looking for inspirational stories about women in law, then this is the podcast for you. Join me and my lawyer ladies as we enjoy a glass of wine after a hard day at work and talk about the world of women in law. It's my passion to share stories of amazing legal ladies who are working as in-house legal counsel, who have law firm roles, who are leading on boards, and who are doing law differently. From time to time, I will also invite special guests on the show to share their insights on legal recruiting and tips for getting hired as a successful lawyer in Japan. I hope you will enjoy getting to know these amazing women who I am so proud to share a profession with. I'm glad you're here and I hope you enjoy the show. Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of the Lawyer on Air podcast. In this episode, I share with you another diverse story of a woman working in the law in Japan. I'm Catherine, the host of the show, and I'm a lawyer based in Tokyo for more than 20 years, and I love helping unlock the wisdom of the stories that women never tell. What I've learned from working in the law in Japan is the importance of personal relationships, and you can attain a much warmer and easier response with people in person than you can online, especially in Japan. And you've got to be aware that perfection is still king in Japan, rather than allowing for the 80-20 rule. Well, those insights are what you will hear today from my guest on the show, Vivian Clancy. Vivian is a client relationship manager and legal operations specialist based in Tokyo, with a background in-house, in a startup and private practice. Before moving to Tokyo, she was the senior legal operations manager in Singapore, supporting the HSF corporate teams across Asia. Vivian has a wealth of experience in the legal operations space, including supporting a major mining company's legal transformation initiatives. If you are gunning for a legal operations role and wondering how to do that, then this is the episode for you. And you can check out Vivian's full bio in the show notes. On this episode, Vivian shares her exciting adventure in law before she became a lawyer, and how these experiences she had in France, in England, and the USA, doing different bits and pieces, have helped to shape her career in law. She also shares her playbook to success in a career in legal operations. This is an absolute gem of a deep dive into the world of legal operations and how her qualifications in design thinking have been absolutely essential to build her rapport with people and prepare them for change in the legal operations space. If you are interested in this area, you really are going to take away so much from what Vivian shares with us. She also shares her favorite expression and what it was about Japan that she loves, and her favorite legal operations podcast that she listens to. Let's get into it. Hi, Vivian, and welcome to the show.
Hi, Catherine. Good morning.
Thanks so much for coming along onto the show today. And I always have the same starting question. If we were meeting up in person, where would we be? Do you have a favorite wine bar or restaurant or cafe you love to go to? And if you do, what would you choose from the menu? Preferably a beverage.
Oh, okay. Well, I don't know if I'm revealing your trade secrets here, Catherine, but it's quite early in the morning. So I'd probably be at a Bill's getting a cappuccino and an avocado toast. Oh. Very typically Australian.
All right. Okay. And if it was allowed to have something to drink with it, what would you'd have your cappuccino, right? So you're not going on the alcohol end of the scale today, no?
Well, maybe if it's a weekend, we can have a mimosa.
Oh, lovely. Thank you so much. That's great. All right. Well, let's continue then on into your amazing career that you've had. And it's so interesting, especially because you do legal operations, and we'll get into that in a moment. But let's go back a little bit to when you were a child, or maybe even a young adult, what kinds of careers you were thinking about, or what you had some sort of curiosity about. And the reason I ask this question is a lot of people find that those curiosities they had at the beginning of their life actually tie into what they're doing now. So what is it for you?
Yeah, I guess that's really interesting. I had pretty varied interest as a child. was, made to do many musical instruments, sports, etc., but really loved actually technology. So I used to have this like little mini camera that I'd make videos on as a kid and was always curious about computers, but at the same time really loved art as well. So I did that all the way through school, but at the same time doing, advanced maths and chemistry. So just a bit of a mixed bag. And I think that actually kind of does reflect where I've ended up.
That is very interesting, right? The sciences, tech, but also arty. I think you're going to reveal that it does actually tie in to what we're going to talk about today. How incredible. Wow. But then you've got this law thing comes up because you were in your early days a lawyer. You've transformed yourself now. But when did studying law as a topic come up for you, given you were talking about maths and chemistry and tech and music and sports?
Yeah, so actually, it's the love of English. So I really love English as a subject, and just thought that law really kind of lent into that kind of critical thinking, looking at discourses and pulling out arguments based on the literature. And yeah, that kind of just led me into law, and I was lucky enough to get in as well. There was a little bit of a put it down, see what happens moment, and c'est la vie, I guess.
Wow, did someone guide you or influence you along the way there? Like law, from what you've said, having it sort of bubble up. I know you're loving the language, but if I think about myself, I liked English, but I didn't see a connection between English and law so much. So I wonder if there was anyone who helped you out there, just sort of said, "Hey, what about law?"
I guess growing up, a lot of our family friends were lawyers. So I had a bit of exposure to that. So I guess I was in some ways exposed sort of through osmosis. But also, I think as well, it's quite an academic kind of profession. So my English teacher sort of spoke about it with me, and he was amazing. I loved him.
Oh wow, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
English teacher. But I love that, the osmosis into law. That's something I don't think I've heard anyone say yet. That's cool. So you did law then, right? You went into university, you got accepted. What happened then?
Yeah, so I went to Melbourne University. I moved from Brisbane to Melbourne to go to university. And actually, I grew up in country Queensland. So then went to boarding school in Brisbane, then went to Melbourne. So it's kind of like stepping bigger and bigger, always looking for a different experience. And so went down to Melbourne and lived in a residential hall and went through Melbourne Law School and made some amazing friends and, had a bit of fun along the way, went on exchange, I guess sort of. Probably I wouldn't say engaged too much with law until towards the end of the degree.
You're being so honest, right?
Yeah, but I mean, it's a pretty heavy subject to take on
Is.
when you're 18.
So what's this exchange that you did?
I was lucky enough to do two. So I did King's College in London for a semester, and I actually did some of their war studies department subjects alongside like some literature ones, like French and Americans in London in the 1930s, and also French. But it was just an awesome experience to be in London and walking around. King's College is right next to the courts in London. So you got to see a lot of the people walking around in their wigs and their costumes and things. Yeah, it was just an awesome experience. And then I did a legal subject exchange to the Sorbonne in Paris, and I did international arbitration. Was a special summer subject that was partly run by Cornell as well. And that was awesome because they had their LLM students there doing it. And then there were students from all around the world. It was sort of 7 weeks intensely of international arbitration in one of the arbitral hubs. So.
Wow, that's incredible. What great exposure to real life, I would say, outside of pure university study of law, to see these things in front of you. Amazing experiences. And could you do those throughout your law degree? You could take the time out to do those. Were they encouraged by Melbourne University?
Definitely encouraged by Melbourne University, and the I actually did arts law, so I saved up my four art subjects and did intense, like swapped them around so I could do the King's College Exchange, and then Melbourne University counted my arbitration subject as one of my subjects.
Wow. So, amazing. Yeah. That's such great exposure at, you know, 18, 19, 20. I'm thinking that's how old you were then.
I was at university for a bit longer than I probably should have been.
Yeah, but isn't that great, though, that you could spend a bit more time there? And what does it matter at the end of the day, right? And some people come into university a bit late. They've done a bit of work and then go into university. I think, especially in countries such as yours and mine, we've got a little bit more flexibility there to do a little something first, go and do law. Or as you're doing law, you take a little bit of a deviation and do these kinds of really exciting things. Wow. And then, so you must have graduated and you did become a lawyer. Tell us about your young lawyer life and the experience that you had in private practice.
Well, actually, just before I started working, so I graduated and set it up, so I had about 8 months in between.
And
went off on another adventure. So I got Australians used to be able to get, I don't know if it's still possible, but working holiday visas for the US. And so I went over there in 2012 before I started my grad role and was a volunteer in the Democrats' office in New York for Obama. So I helped organize like phone banks and door knocking, and like we'd get on the bus and go to like Pennsylvania or Philly or whatever and talk to people. And there was a little crew of Aussies in that office doing the same thing. So they sort of had a bit of a New York adventure as well before deciding I probably should come back and work and get a job and make some money.
You are such an adventurer. I would never have, I mean, it's not on your profile on LinkedIn, but it should be there maybe that you've, you know, got these adventures in law, and perhaps that's the topic of, or the title of this episode. It all depends how it goes at the end there, but adventures in the law, you are having that. Did you ever meet Mr. Obama?
No.
Anyone close to him?
The people who'd been there for multiple campaigns, you know, staffers were the ones that got the invites to meet Mr. Obama and Mrs. Obama.
How exciting. Well, that would have been really like almost your CV is quite full before you even start becoming a lawyer. I don't know many people, Vivian, who would have the kind of experience you've got before you've actually started to do law, but sort of semi-related to the law. They've all got ties in, and I think it's really amazing what you've done. So let me then ask about your first few years then as a lawyer. They must have been a little bit different to these adventures you had.
And I'm like, I don't know if I get more boring. Let's see. I started at Allens in Melbourne and went into the competition team, which I actually really loved that subject at university because it was a mix of sort of economics and business reasoning alongside legal application. And that was a really great team. And at Allens, you did 1 year rotations. So I spent a year there. And then I moved into the funds team and did a mix of investments and also superannuation advisory. And along the way, basically my partner at the time and I decided we wanted to get out of Australia for a bit. We were a bit bored. You can probably sense why, given the discussion we just had about what I've been up to. And so we started to look for opportunities overseas and ended up in Singapore.
Right. What did you do there?
I went into the M&A team at Linklaters in Singapore and did a lot of private equity M&A basically, which was a pretty intense experience going from the groups I'd been in before into sort of multinational, multi-time zone M&A. But it was a really great office, lots of amazing smart people there. It just probably wasn't for me. So after about 18 months, 2 years, I ran away from private practice, we'll say.
Ran away. Love it.
Yeah.
I can actually see you like, I'm out of here, shutting the door and literally running out of the building. Where did you go to? Where did you run to?
To a startup. So,
well, that's a big change. What happened there? Startup.
Goodness. Yeah. So I was looking for a new role in Singapore and basically wanted a divergent experience to what I'd had previously. I would say probably this was the venture in me looking for different experiences as opposed to rational career planning. But anyway, this startup called RingMD was looking for legal counsel. And I thought, why not? I'll go talk to them. And the guy who was the COO slash GC was an ex-Latham's lawyer. And I was like, wow, I can learn from this guy and be in this really exciting startup environment. And they spoke about having partnerships in the pipeline with Facebook and Microsoft, using mobile technology, I guess, to get access to healthcare. So in the countries in Southeast Asia where healthcare access is limited, but everyone carries a phone and has access to the internet. So opening up their healthcare access in that way. And I just thought, this is cool. I want to do this. And so lucky enough, got hired by the startup and again, was surrounded by some really interesting sort of people. The founder himself was a 26-year-old American chap who'd done some backpacking around Asia and basically saw that there was low access to healthcare, but people were holding their phones, and got funding from the Singaporean government to set up his business. And it had been around for a couple of years by the time I joined, and there was 26 people there, basically. So the head of marketing was ex-Uber. The head of sales was a guy who'd come from this British tech company. I can't remember the name now. I think it's called Gecko. So it's just sort of, that's what I wanted to do after being in private practice.
It couldn't be more different, right? It could not be more different, but how thoroughly exciting. I don't even know why you're not still there, actually, but that is super fun. And how amazing that somebody had the idea to get people who couldn't normally get access to healthcare, but recognize the link between them having their phones and being able to tap into an app, I'm assuming, and book or find out information or where they can get the access to the healthcare they needed. That is super amazing. And it's giving a social, you know, giving back to a community, isn't it? It's got a for-purpose startup.
Yeah, and this is pre-COVID time. So, I mean, the reason I'm not there is unfortunately things started to come unwound and I left, and then maybe a year or so later it actually wound up. So
okay, it's a shame. Is this sort of the lead into where you find yourself into legal operations with this tech starting from that area? Is that where we're going to from here?
Yeah, so I started in a very sort of legal role doing, you know, investor relations, the actual looking at healthcare regulations in each country, data requirements, you know, company structures, procurement contracts, partnership contracts, that kind of thing. And then it morphed really into more of a broader ops role. And I did some really cool stuff that kind of just opened my eyes to, you know, agile project management. We ran agile cycles for product development. Myself and the head of sales sort of spoke about, why don't we, there's all this regulatory like tape doing proper healthcare provision with doctors. Why don't we look at the allied professionals and do, you know, people who want to have access to, say, counseling or other services which aren't necessarily, you know, within the definitions that restrict healthcare. And so I was basically allowed to set that up with the tech team. And so was part of that product development and saw how it all worked. And when the role came up to join HSF in Singapore, I thought, this is an intersection of an industry that I know. And also I can go deeper into all of these things that I've been exposed to and really liked doing. So it sort of seemed to make sense.
So was the HSF Singapore role an operations role, legal operations role?
Yeah, so it was originally the team started as legal project management. And then I think 2 weeks after I started, changed into legal operations. So the mandate became much broader. I think HSF were quite early movers in this space to have a legal ops team at a law firm. In fact, just to have a legal ops team. And that's really the visionary of the leaders of that team who started many years ago. So that's Libby Jarvis in Australia and Ian Gilbert in the UK.
Wow, that's really interesting because I seem to remember legal operations coming up as a thing, a job. Maybe it was 2016, 17. I remember it sort of emerging when I was in a company and they were looking for someone for that role. And I remember thinking, what is this at that time? Interesting. This is a little bit after that. Is that around 2020 that we are at now when you did
No,
that role?
2018. So after
2018.
you,
Okay. So it is similar timing. Wow. Okay. So tell us a bit more about that. What happened? You joined them and what were you into then?
I joined and I was this third hire in the team in Asia. And my role was to support the transactional practice groups in Asia. So that's, equity, capital markets, corporate, and finance. And across all the HSF offices in Asia, which is, China, Hong Kong, Thailand, Singapore, HBT in Indonesia, KL, so all Tokyo, it's a list. And as one person, there's only so much that you can achieve. And what the team was set up originally for, as I mentioned, is legal project management. So that was really a way to understand how the teams worked, stresses, pain points, etc., when you did that legal project management role, because you were working on matters with the teams and helping them essentially originally manage costs and communications with the clients. But it evolved beyond that to setting up the technology that would be used for those sort of matters. And in some circumstances, it was also data analysis of the time and the costs and playing that back to the client to understand, where things had diverged and gone out of scope and, have those discussions. So that's kind of the foundation of it. And then I think as the industry has shifted, technology has improved, it sort of became wider and wider role and more strategic. So I did things like strategy implementation for the practice groups. That was actually the strategy covered clients and markets, people and culture, and also the financials, because from what I'd been doing, it was a touch point with all of those things, designing training programs for different levels of legal professionals so that they could understand legal operations and legal project management, where they could get help, what tools we had. If you're a trainee, what your role is with this technology versus if you're a partner, what's your interaction with this? Or, even things like financial responsibility and hygiene. So it's really a role that touched many elements of the law firm. And as things changed as well, it became client advisory. So we started talking to our clients because they're like, hey, we've heard about this legal ops thing. You've got a legal ops team. What are you doing? I really enjoyed that. And one of the biggest things that I did was an 18-month secondment to BHP to basically do a global legal transformation project and help them set up their legal ops team.
Wow, amazing. That's incredible. What experience you've had. And after you came back from BHP secondment, what happened then?
Life. No, I ended that. There's a comment ended because I had a baby. So,
Fair enough. Okay. And then you took a bit of time out then?
a bit of time out. And during that time as well, my husband accepted an opportunity to come to Tokyo, but the borders were closed. So,
Ah,
kind
being
of a
out in
little
COVID.
bit. Yeah.
Right. What
So,
did you
we're talking,
do? How did you manage that then? Did he work from remotely for a little while there before he could come in?
So he worked from the Singapore office, basically.
Okay.
He's a lawyer as well. So he
Yeah.
worked for a law firm in Singapore before we
Okay.
came up here.
Right. So what happened then with coming over to Japan eventually? Because that's where you are now. So you must have come in at some point. Tell us a bit more about that.
Well, we came as soon as the borders opened because we'd given up the lease on our house and we'd been waiting for so long that actually we have a cat. And Japan has very strict rabies testing requirements. You get the serology test done and then you have to wait 180 days. And we'd got that done in, January of 2021 and it was about to expire. So my husband actually came a week earlier than me and my son because the cat wouldn't have been able to get in.
Okay, so your husband came earlier, not with a child, with a cat. That's funny. Yeah, that's funny. Very practical. And then you followed.
Yes,
And
and then we followed.
you were with HSF here, so what did you do here?
Yeah, so the Tokyo office is a smaller office for HSF, and they had a real need for a client relationship manager and sort of general BD manager for the team here, and they asked me to do that. So when I moved across, I moved into this client relationship and BD role, but I took and have and still do obviously use a lot of my legal ops skills now, and I'm still keenly interested in legal operations and get involved where I can.
Right. And I think I would say Tokyo is rather different to Singapore, not only the seasons, but all kinds of things. How did you find life when you landed your feet in Japan, settled in and, started to explore this country?
It actually surprised me a lot because I find Japan is so that has a reputation of being so technologically advanced, and in some ways is. But when you move here as an expat, the life admin and the level of paper and repetition is astounding. And I actually was like, someone needs to do a process business transformation of these ward offices, because I think the amount of times I've filled out the same information is driving me mental, and carrying around like five different cards, in comparison to Singapore, where your visa is also your ID is also everything, and that's it. There's one card. So my initial impression was like, this is sort of an interesting contrast. There's so many things that are so well advanced, and then in other aspects isn't so not, we'll say.
Tell me about it. Life admin, yes. And, printing out paper forms and you write information at the top of the form and then you're repeating it further down the form. It's like, well, isn't it just there? No, you have to write it again. And it's just a little bit strange somehow. I think you're right. If anyone's listening, business transformation for ward offices in Japan is a project desperately waiting to happen. Okay.
I did actually see that they are trialing the use of AI in some ward offices. So, maybe it's happening.
Wow, that's really good to hear. Excellent. Good on you, Japan. So do you think it's quite different here then, being an expat and developing your career path here compared to other countries such as Singapore and Australia?
Definitely. So Singapore has positioned itself to be an international hub for Asia Pacific. So, I mean, operationally, the language is English. Everyone speaks English, so that's obviously an easier hurdle than Japan. But because of the tax incentives for individuals and companies to be there, there are a lot of APAC headquarters in Singapore. And so the opportunity to actually have regional roles and coverage are there. Whereas what I've found here is that because Japan has such a large population, a lot of the international companies that are here are domestically focused. And so even though it might be a domestic or say regional even role, operationally Japanese is required. And obviously, because if you're interacting with the customers or the business relationships here, that's all what's needed. Yeah. So
Yeah, so
that's
are you using Japanese at all in your work?
No, so we operate completely in English. I think it's
Right.
an anomaly.
Are there any different perspectives so that you've seen operating here in the legal industry compared to other countries? Like maybe, the way that people are working with you or the way you're working with organizations or the clients you're dealing with. Is there something a little bit different there that pops up for you?
So I've definitely encountered a few differences. I'd say the first would be here the importance of personal relationships and spending time with people. So I think, unlike what I've experienced in other markets and countries, here is definitely very strongly towards FaceTime, even in a post-COVID era. And I think for a lot of other countries, they've sort of said, ah, we don't need to do that. But it's amazing the difference in even the responses you will get, right? You see someone in person and it's warmer and it facilitates what you're trying to do. Whereas I think you can get a lot of polite declines by email.
Why is that? Why do you think that FaceTime is so important? Is it because it brings out that trust in people to be next to someone and they can feel more part of the conversation? Is there quite a big difference there for Japanese, do you think, than online?
I'm not sure. I don't think I have been here long enough to understand that. Maybe I will never understand it because I'm not Japanese. I'd just say it's an initial observation that I've made. And I think the other one as well would be definitely working in startup environment and in Aussie firms, sort of 80-20 is okay. 80% there, but meet the deadline and like it doesn't have to be perfect, just get it done. But I think here things have to be perfect, which is what I've observed, which I think maybe there's something to learn from that too, because there's real pride in that perfection.
Maybe I've been thinking a lot about that lately, and I wonder if it's neither is bad, they're just different. And how could we morph those a little bit more smoothly, dovetail them, I suppose. But yeah, good observations, those two. Well, I do want to go into a deeper dive into your legal operations. But before we do that, let's just pause and maybe answer this sentence for me. The most important thing I've learned in my career in this legal industry so far is.
I think the most important thing is that lawyers are incredibly intelligent people. And when you work with lawyers and only lawyers, you expect that kind of diligence and intelligence from everyone. And it's not necessarily the rest of the world. And I think because of that, there is huge appetite for embracing, the role. Law is so prolific, right? And actually, it's in the fabric of everything that we do, and we don't realize it. You download an app, the legal protections in there are, in the terms and conditions, the data privacy acts that sit behind it. I don't know, you have a traffic infringement interacting with the law again. It's everywhere. And I think because of that importance, I guess, there's a lot of really amazing, intelligent people working in this industry.
So let's get into some more about this wonderful world of legal operations. What is your definition of legal operations?
It's the foundational and operational aspects of running a legal team and legal processes at a company, I think. And basically, the levers of legal ops are processes, resources, and technology. And it is, in a lot of ways, a transformation and management kind of role.
That's interesting because a lot of people confuse, I think, legal tech as the same as legal ops, but I like how you've said it's one of the levers. It's not the absolute legal
Yeah,
ops.
and legal tech actually makes, and tech in general, makes a lot of noise and gets a lot of people excited. And where a lot of teams trip up is they actually get really excited and say, we're going to buy this thing, but they don't actually understand the processes, the workflows that are being done by their team and how it will fit into them properly. And a lot of tech providers don't actually do the level of analysis needed. So you sort of get this square peg in a round hole, and you end up with some really expensive tech, and you're sort of forcing it on your team to say, you've got to do this now. And it doesn't actually help or make the process more efficient. And that seems to happen a lot, unfortunately.
Well, you mentioned legal teams there, and maybe that's a good place to ask this question about how do the legal teams actually identify where they start this legal operations journey?
Yeah, so I think it's about listening to your team and ultimately the consumer of legal services, which is your business stakeholders, to understand the pain points. So it sounds like you're going looking for trouble, but actually, I think there's no point trying to solve for something that isn't a problem. because there's going to be many things that actually could make a big difference. And it's kind of taking the time to understand, one, what the problems are, but two, what's the return on investment if you try and fix those problems. And unfortunately, a lot of teams just don't have the bandwidth to actually do that kind of investigation. It's a hard one because I think a lot of people just say, we're getting more work and we don't have enough people to do it, which is itself a good, it's a fair enough starting point, but that's the start of the investigation.
Wow. Okay. So could you talk to me a bit about the, well, to the extent you can, on any of this experience or projects you've actually dealt with, some of these pain points that you've been able to solve, if you can talk about those?
When I started my secondment at BHP, they were partway through an exercise where they'd done a big survey of the legal team. They'd gone through all the work streams that they did. They said, these are the ones that have to stay with legal. As they are, they're fine. These are the ones that we have to do differently, but stay with legal. And these are the ones we have to get rid of altogether. But it was sort of just kind of a laundry list of stuff. And then what we did was get that laundry list and actually dig deeper into each of them. In order to understand what they are, you have to do interviews with all of the people that actually do them and sort of say, okay, if you were telling someone else how to do this and what they needed to do, what would you say the steps were? Mm. What are the knowledge artifacts that they would need in order to do it, like a precedent or a playbook? And just stepping through that to actually understand where we could do things differently. So there was a bucket, by way of example, that was upskilling the business. Like, that was how broad it was. And we quickly identified that that was too broad a bucket, but also you actually need to have the legal expertise and the day-to-day knowledge of that business unit in order to do it. So it wasn't something that could be, say, either automated using a chatbot or you know, a FAQ document, or I guess lifted and shifted to another team. So that was just kind of one example that went in the, okay, no, we've got to rethink it. But there was, you know, a long list of other things. So there was like a risk matrix for what legal had to review, and certain categories of contract, it was decided that would be more efficient for it to go through a central team that only did that type of contract. And the teams that were doing it originally were then tasked with working on a playbook for that central team to be upskilled in order to do it. But I mean, this is like two of eight work streams that this happened for. And throughout this whole process, so stepping back a little bit, I guess one of the big things that we did was we set up a new central team in KL to manage certain work streams that it was determined would be better to be done by one central team as opposed to teams that sat alongside business units. And that's a huge change management exercise because you're essentially, you know, changing some people's day-to-day, and there were definitely people who were nervous about that. And so part of the process is actually making it co-designed project. So there were representatives globally from each of the legal teams that were kind of the, I guess, the change champions, but they were also actively working on the project. And we made a very precise stakeholder map where we had to understand all the touch points of where each of these work streams changes would impact and what level of communication those stakeholders would need, and really tried to take especially the legal team on the journey and involved them in the decision making more broadly about what was happening. Yeah. So yeah.
Right. So that sounds like one of like the biggest challenges that you'd have is making sure everyone feels emotionally engaged in the project, that they're not being ousted or shoved off to some other area that where they did doing work that they didn't want to do. So these are the typical issues and challenges that teams are facing, right?
Definitely. And I think one of the most important roles for legal ops teams is actually this change management role, which is not as, I guess, sexy as legal tech, but it's the most important because it means that your solution will be embedded properly. People will use it. people will understand it and the team will have played a part in designing it. And actually that just kind of touches on sort of how you start these kind of things. A lot of legal ops teams use a methodology called design thinking, which is really about sort of stepping through a process where actually the facilitator almost is putting together the framework and consolidating ideas, but it all comes from the team that you're designing for, so that it is essentially a solution that they've come up with themselves, and they're invested in it and they're invested in the process. And this sort of design methodology is not just used for legal ops, it's actually can be used for product design in tech companies, in consumer companies. It's sort of all about empathize. So listening to everyone, understanding the problem, understanding what you're trying to solve for. You define the problem and define what you're trying to solve. And sometimes that can look like a how might we question is how it gets phrased. So how might we make our response time to the business 2 hours or something?
Right.
And then you go big again and you ideate. And so everyone, the idea is to use brainstorming tools here. So there's different techniques that you can use, but you basically want to get people's wildest ideas and then you put restraints on it. You say, so what if you had like no budget? Or like, what if you had $1? What if you can't actually do any tech? Well, you know, that kind of thing, to try and get people to think outside the box. What if you were Google and you were going to do this? And then you come up with a solution and you do design it and then you test it and you iterate it. And so you get feedback on that and you try and understand how to make it better. And then you go again. And what this looks like in a legal ops environment is usually a pilot or a test of a new process in a small confined team, and then expanding on that as you refine it and make it more fit for purpose.
How are you finding people embrace this process? Because I've been through a couple of design thinking challenges with some groups and joined them, and you'll find that some people who are the real details people will get right into the details first up, and for them it's hard to go broad, and then for the ones who think broadly it's hard, a little harder for them to go right into details. So how do you manage those different groups? Is it about getting them ready and prepared by explaining the process, or is there something more as you're going along in this process for design thinking?
Yeah, so I ran a workshop, which was essentially an intro to design thinking with a group of lawyers. And the way we kind of started the exercise was doing simple drawings of flowers. So just taking it like completely away and trying to sort of get people thinking creatively, but outside of that really technical kind of like small thinking, and then showed how different everyone's was based off, you know, same instructions. And then you've really got to, I guess, use the group. And there's nothing wrong with people getting stuck in the weeds. It's just maybe that's, you know, for another part in the process.
Yeah.
And that alongside big thinking is always very helpful. But you do have to kind of guide people to stay within the confines of the exercise that they're doing. And I do find that the real aha moment for a lot of things comes when you're in the ideating bucket is so big. So people have a lot of fun coming up with these crazy ideas. And then you've actually got to figure out, you know, what's realistic. So there's always some kind of rationalization that happens. And a lot of the time that's sort of putting things on a matrix with effort and return. And so you end up with a quadrant that's kind of quick wins, high investment but high return, low investment but high return. So that's quick wins, or sort of low investment, low return. Maybe we won't do those. And then you kind of dive into the, okay, like, let's see where we're going to focus. And I think that's when people get a real aha moment, because you get almost a list of potential projects when you started with something so vague and broad. And I think if you take people on that journey, it really brings out, once you've done it once, you're kind of like, oh yeah, I can see how this works, because you do get the divergent opinions, but that's kind of the beauty of it as well.
And I seem to remember with the people who go into the details pretty quickly is not to say, hey, we're going to do that later, to actually take a couple of those down that they're already thinking of and put them on the side of the whiteboard or wherever you're working, so they feel valued, that they've been at least a little bit heard with their detailed ideas that are coming up right then and there. So capture those, but then move on with the process. But I like how you've used like flowers as a really away from legal or the actual problem that you're talking about, but helping them see the difference or the way that you can evolve that flower, right? From big, I can almost got a picture in my mind of what the flower looked like at the beginning down to getting to a Van Gogh, right? So yeah. Awesome. Wonderful. Is there something here though too about how you show value, how you'd show and demonstrate the value of these projects and put together a business case for this kind of work?
Definitely, because I think a lot of these projects require either time from your legal team or spend for external resources to come and help you change your process, or spend for, say, an investment in technology. So basic metrics, I guess, on the value of these projects is, you know, potentially how much you'll save the business. The thing is too, it's got to be communicated ultimately to the business and a benefit to them as well as to legal. Mm-hmm. So, you know, response time to the business or ability for them to self-serve, so facilitate quicker contract negotiations in certain settings. Definitely sales teams love that. Also, like hours of legal's time. So if you identify that your team is spending like, you know, at least an hour a day looking at reviewing bills or something, that's not an efficient use of time for someone with a law degree. It can be done by a computer, at least in the first case, and maybe it'd make it a 15-minute review. And then the second level is, I guess, so once you've identified that maybe there is a time saving or a dollar saving, then I guess the ability for legal to focus on different things. So like de-risking the business or proactively working alongside the business or exploring new areas that they want to develop products or services, or creating a group to look at potential technology changes. So AI interest group or something, and getting in front of the issues and understanding the regulatory landscape. So if the business wants to do it, it's already, the path is there. Or indeed, I think just generally people are saying the regulatory landscape is expanding alongside most businesses, and there is a need for more lawyers. So saving their time doing lower value work means that they can do this other work.
Really great. I also have to ask you a little bit more about, I guess it's called legal tech, but the rise of AI and these other large language models, the LLMs that we're hearing a lot about, you know, that can mimic human intelligence. What are you thinking about these, the rise of these in the industry and impact into the legal fraternity? What do you think?
Well, I mean, there's a lot, everyone's really excited about LLMs since, you know, OpenAI made it open to the public at the end of last year. And, you know, there's been, I think it was Goldman Sachs came out with a report that said, you know, 40%+ of legal tasks in the US could be done by generative AI. And, you know, they've had, I think it's ChatGPT-4 has passed the bar exam in the US and that kind of thing. So people are excited, worried, scared perhaps, but, you know, we won't see the application of it for a long time properly in a workplace, and it's going to affect everyone, not just legal. But I think as well, the nature of the legal profession is such that we have a professional responsibility and a duty of care in the provision of our advice, which means that human lawyer will always have to be involved. And to the extent that the more legal advice can be given or more work can be done with the use of these tools, I think that's pretty amazing, because it means there will be more access to justice for people and access to a specialist like legal expertise that maybe wasn't there. But we don't actually know what the full impact is going to be on the profession yet, but there will be a change.
It's very exciting, isn't it? I sometimes think of the tools as being like an assistant that helps you do your work a little bit faster or more efficiently, and then you always need the lawyer as the human check, shall we say, not that assistants aren't human, but if we compare it to AI, the check that you need to do at the end, because they don't get things right all the time. It's a good prompt to have, but also we do need the overlay of lawyers. I don't think we're out of a job quite yet.
No, actually the Harvard Business Review did a study of 750 BCG consultants using ChatGPT, and they used it sort of not to do the work, but to augment, I guess, what they were doing. And there were different buckets. So, you know, some had training with AI, some hadn't, and then some weren't using it at all so that they could measure the difference. And the higher performers completed 12% more work, 25% faster, and the lower performers were lifted by 40%. But there were still issues with accuracy, and it wasn't predictable when it failed. But used as a tool, just like you say, it was amazingly effective. So I think that's pretty, yeah, it'll be interesting to see where things go.
Wow.
And there's a famous Bill Gates quote, and he said, "We always overestimate the change that will occur in the next 2 years and underestimate the change that will occur in the next 10. Don't let yourself be lulled into inaction."
Mm.
And I just think that's so true for AI. Like, everyone's so excited. It's going to like change everything, but you know, we're all going to be underestimating what'll happen in the future.
Absolutely. Great, great quote. I love it. All right. Well, we're going to wind down the episode today. But before we do that, is there anything else that you wanted to add in here that we didn't cover, or something else that you wanted to reemphasize that you'd already spoken about?
I guess I would just say there's a lot of great resources out there for people who are interested in legal ops. And I think that the technology that we're seeing now and that is being hyped up is, you know, really exciting, but you can't bring that in unless you understand your processes and workflows to begin with. And I think, you know, a lot of teams can just get started by understanding that, understanding what data is important for them to capture, and doing things like, you know, thinking about a knowledge management system, because essentially these AI tools will be built off and are as good as the data that's in them. So if you are to have something that is using the data or knowledge from what your own system has, so domain-specific LLMs, then you have to have that information there. You know, it can't all be disparate in different systems. So in some ways, I think the steps you could take now are kind of just those initial housekeeping steps, really, and to see where the technology will come in over the top as a tool to help facilitate those processes and workflows. You've got to understand them first.
Great. Wow. Exciting. Okay. Well, let's finish up the podcast on a lighter note. Stage three. So we've done your career and looked at you gallivanting around university. We've done a little bit about legal ops here. So this last section is just a little lighter note, maybe a few sort of curious questions to wind down the show. You've only been in Japan, what, 1 year and a few months, is it? Nearly 2 years. Is that about right?
18 months, yeah.
18 months, there you go. What's the one thing you love about Japan?
There's so much to love about Japan. I actually really love that you can go to a hotel and not really have to pack anything. You can just get into the yukata and there's a toothbrush for you and hairbrush and everything you could possibly need. And I think that's kind of just generally a lot of experiences in Japan are thought, they're thinking of the ultimate user, and they make it so easy and delightful for you.
Oh, what a great answer. Is there a favorite saying that you have in Japanese or English? You mentioned Bill Gates before. Is there something that that comes up for you as your kind of mantra or things that you often hear yourself saying?
Ganbarimasu.
I'll do my best, right? I'll go for it.
Yeah.
Good. How about a recent, maybe a book that you've read, or perhaps if you're listening to a podcast of some sort that you'd recommend?
I mean, this is going to be nerdy, but also recommending on for a friend is the Legal Ops podcast. So they talk about all things legal ops, legal business, and legal tech, and they're actually starting an online institute, and the first topic is AI. So if anyone's got an interest in that, Definitely. And then otherwise, I wish I had more time for leisure reading.
Is the Legal Ops podcast hosted by an Australian company?
So it's two individuals, so Alex Rosenrouch and Elliot Labou, and yeah, they just do it themselves.
Oh, wonderful. Okay. If you weren't doing what you're doing now, what would you be doing, do you think?
Depends what day you get me. I think sometimes have grand dreams of setting up a ceramics business. I don't know why, but I just really love homewares. And then other days think that perhaps I'd just disappear into the French countryside or something. But maybe that's just because I'm tired.
Wow, amazing. If you could give one piece of advice to your younger self, right, when you were a lawyer or coming through to Singapore, etc., what would that piece of advice be?
I think I still need the advice now, to be honest, Catherine. I don't know that I have anything wise to say to younger me.
Well, what would you say to yourself now? What have you got to do or tell yourself to be okay about?
Well, I think I need to apply that Bill Gates quote to my life, I think, and definitely feel like I need to upskill myself to stay ahead of, you know, the potential changes that are coming, or even just to understand it, right? It's evolving so rapidly. And I don't think there's an easy way to plan for it either, because I think so many jobs or careers that don't exist will exist. So.
Well, Vivian, we have come to the end of a truly incredible chat today, all about legal operations and your adventures earlier in your life. That's amazing. Thank you so much for coming on the Lawyer on Air podcast.
Thank you for having me, Catherine. It's great to chat.
Yeah, it's been a great pleasure. And for listeners who are interested in connecting and learning more from you about this area you've been talking about, where's the best place to reach out to you?
Yep, probably on LinkedIn is probably the easiest way.
Great. We'll put your details there in the show notes. And to everyone who is listening, if you enjoyed this episode and it's inspired you in some way, please subscribe to the podcast, get online and tell us what your biggest takeaway was. And head over to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your podcast and leave us a review. That really helps us share around the podcast episodes with people broadly and more widely. So thanks, everybody. That's all for today. I'll see you on the next episode. Cheers, kanpai, and bye for now. Thank you so much for listening today to this episode of Lawyer on Air. I really hope that you were inspired by the story you heard and that you discovered something new about women in the law. Please subscribe to the show so that you don't miss future episodes. And if you can think of even just one person to share this episode with, that would make my day. I invite you to connect with me to talk more. Jump on over to LinkedIn or Instagram where you can find me, or send me a message via my website contact page. That's all from me today. I look forward to seeing you right here on the next episode of Lawyer on Air. Cheers, kanpai, and bye for now.